Great pleasure to be introducing an old friend and colleague of mine, Malcolm Rule, here on this cold December day, December the 15th, 2002. Malcolm is now retired, but was part of the great generation of British social anthropologists of the mid-20th century and later 20th century. So Malcolm, when were you born? Let's just start with that.
Oh, I was born 75 years ago in 1927, which is quite a long time. I would say I was really second generation, that the EPs and the Meyer Fortesses and even, you know, others were older than me. So I came into a subject which was filled with the great and the good, the real figures. In chairs and lived a career where they had resigned, and anthropology became a different kind of subject, really. Much more people involved in it, much wider number of people teaching, much larger number of people taking anthropology courses. I came into it in a way in the back door. I came to Downing under F.R. Leavis.
Did you?
And there were a number of anthropologists who came from F.R. Leavis.
Jack did English too.
Jack did English. Baxter, Leonhardt, Peter Leonhardt, all came via Leavis. And indeed, when I remember in 1950, when I came across, was thinking of doing anthropology, having done part one of the English tripos and was not sufficient of a Leavis disciple to want to do 3 years, and was looking then for an appropriate subject for part two, and I was introduced to Godfrey Leonhardt by Peter Leonhardt, who was a contemporary of mine, where we both took the scholarship exam in Downing.
What year was that? That was...
Well, so the year I moved across, the year I moved across was 1950. It was the first year that Meyer Fortes, for example, and this is a good example of the great and the good going into these chairs. And Meyer was came across to take the chair in Cambridge in the year that I started. So I was the first, one of the first year of Meyer being in. Being at Cambridge, what was I saying? Yes, we went. It was then thought that this was a small world, and then thought that it was a good idea to go to Oxford and meet Meyer before he became a professor, before I became one of his students. And it was E.P. who in Oxford said, "Who is this man, Leavis, is like a brick wall that people react like tennis balls into social anthropology." Yes.
And so you met Meyer. Let's linger on.
I met Meyer in Oxford, who had then been appointed to the chair. That's right. And I remember, the requisite of an anthropologist was really languages in his view, that it was. I did actually have some languages, which was a good thing.
Which languages did you?
Oh, at school, yes, it was French, German, as it happened, Russian as well. What happened to the Russian is another story, and I didn't know Russian very well, though I did get an intermediate higher exam in Russian way back in, when was it, in 1947, I suppose. Mm.
Did he encourage you? Because this is Meyer. Because
Meyer.
People sometimes say that he warned people that if they wanted.
I wasn't encouraged by him. No, I wasn't encouraged by him. I was encouraged by Godfrey Leonhardt, who said that and this was after the war, and it was an expanding subject, and money was available for research, so that it was a good subject to go into. This is what encouraged me, and it was a subject too. It was the year of the Marrett Lecture. I remember very well the discussion amongst students in anthropology, part two students, who had a kind of lunch group, and we talked about the Marrett Lecture.
Who gave it?
The Marit Lecture. This is Evans Pritchard's 1950
The famous one. History and Anthropology.
History and Anthropology, that's right. Where, I mean, it seems to me that, the 1950 and the Marit Lecture establishes a kind of watershed between the scientific, rigorous, positivistic study of anthropology, that anthropology is a natural science, and the move which happened over a number of years to anthropology concerned with meaning, which was an interpretive. And it happened around there, and I'm linking this with the encouragement given to a number of people who came from an art subject. Now, this wasn't Meyer. This wasn't Meyer. Meyer was still interested in establishing a thoroughgoing, rigorous scientific school in Cambridge, which I saw really very little of. I saw really just for 1 year before going to Oxford to do a B.Lit.
I see. So you just did a part two.
I did a 1 year part two. I see. In Cambridge.
Who else was there when you were there? Any other anthropologists?
The people who preceded that year were Eric Stenning, Derek Stenning, Raymond Smith, and the Indian man, whose name I've forgotten, who worked in India.
Srinivas?
No, none of those. Who, I think, left anthropology quite early on. In my own year, I don't think there were significant people, actually, who went on into anthropology.
Who were the other teachers apart from Meyer? Rio was there.
Rio Fortune. And Ethel Lindgren was there.
Oh, yes. Were you there during the great scandal when she was sacked?
That was after that year. Now, I was in fact taught by Ethel Lindgren. I was supervised by Ethel Lindgren.
And by Rio, or
no? Not by Rio, no.
Was he already notoriously strange in his behaviour?
He was strange in his behaviour, yes. What do I remember of that year? Radcliffe Brown came and lectured. It was a year or two before he died. I've forgotten when he died, or what, early 50s, didn't he, Radcliffe Brown?
Was he a good lecturer?
Well, he was famous. At that time, nothing had been published other than papers of his, so that one went through journals to read his papers. You know, Structure and Function in Primitive Society didn't come out till somewhat later, so that one was still working from papers. And of course, there were incredibly few ethnographies that were then available, so we made do with Beak and Rattray and people like that. And G.I. Jones was lecturing.
Was he teaching?
He was teaching, yes.
What was he like as a lecturer?
I remember him giving the ethnographic lectures, and he'd done his homework and was fairly thorough. Not inspiring.
No, rather dry.
Rather dry, yes.
Galvanized Arne was his nickname.
Yes. No.
And he lectured on material culture, because you were doing those subjects too.
No, we avoided material culture.
Did you?
Yes, avoided material culture. Yes, who else? I remember a kind of ray of light when the Bohannans came across from Oxford. And, you know, Bohannans were always enthusiasts, and the anthropologists then were enthusiasts. There was a very thorough, very vigorous anthropology society, and they talked to the anthropology club, and then we met them in where they were staying and sat at their feet.
What was Laura Bohannan like?
She wasn't beautiful, but she was she knew a lot about the two, and was very willing to talk about them.
Wrote some very good
Sorry?
Wrote some wonderful books as well.
Yes, that's right.
Return to Laughter.
That's right. Mm. And went on to do field work in East Africa, which I only, odd papers has been published from that, which is a pity. No, she was impressive. She was impressive. And we very much enjoyed her. I mean, enjoyed having them talking about real life field work. There were a few people around. I think Maya had attracted a few graduate students. Watson, Bill Watson was there. And also...
who later went on to Manchester? Or
who later went on to Manchester, yes. Yes.
Yes, what was Maya like as a, either as a person or, I mean, you knew him later, obviously, but as a teacher and head of department, what were your impressions of him?
Well, much later as head of department, you mean the head of department at that time, 1950. Yes, I mean, he ran a seminar and clearly was wanting, it was about the time that Social Structure was published, essays given to Radcliffe Brown, and he was then, I think, working with his Ashanti material, and he was wanting to introduce the notion of social structure and work it out, and we gave papers.
He was a rather bird-like manner, didn't he? Well, I've just seen him lecture once or twice, sort of staccato, quite quite forceful.
I find it very difficult to go back to the time when he was lecturing. I mean, he's always a man who seems to me that he links what he is doing with some very basic questions. And so... that was stimulating, so he did make us think, and he was concerned to do that, but he also was moving in, as it were, in one direction. He was wanting discussion to go to find one answer or one set of related answers.
Why did you choose to work in Africa then? Was it through his influence or...?
Maya's influence. It was what was available. I did 1 year in Cambridge anthropology, and then since 1 year anthropology didn't make one into an anthropologist, did a B.Litt in Oxford, and I had already come across EP, and I'd already been very impressed by EP, and had gone to EP's radio lectures on social anthropology. So I went a lot. They were given in the Royal Society, Royal Society lecture room, and I went along and actually heard the man in the flesh.
Did he give a whole series, or was he one of that group?
No, he gave a series. The social anthropology, I think there were six. And it was an important series in a way, because it did open up social anthropology to a lot of people. Who hadn't otherwise, wouldn't otherwise have met it. And I was also impressed with the line that he took, I mean, coming from English. So I have downstairs a set of Collingwood volumes that Wendy James in Oxford is now interested in and relating to Evans Pritchett's own sort of intellectual career. So that, in one way, the thought that I should go over from Cambridge to Oxford was very welcome.
Did he become your supervisor then, for your B.Litt?
He examined the B.Litt. The B.Litt was on some East African peoples in relation to their environment, the Nilets, in fact. I mean, as I came from English, EP wanted to give me a topic which was factual and down to earth. Mm. So it was really a study of the Nilotes, Nuadinka particularly, in relation to the flooding of the Sud in the southern Sudan, and that was my B.Lit thesis. Mm. And what happened then that I went to West Africa? It was the Cameroonian Development Project, and money was found in conjunction with the now a Cameroonian research project, which included Edwin Ardner and an economist, Warmington, and my study of Banyang in the hinterland of the Cameroon was associated with that.
Mm. What was your training before you went to the field?
Oh, what was my training? Well, I did... It's a bit overshadowed by the story of the tables, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it was a bit like that, yes. That I would need more tables than I think.
Whose story is that? Is it?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's apocryphal or it's in Laura Bohannon's, Dusty Bohannon, as she was known in her book. That yes, it was. I didn't.
No formal training, really.
No, there was no formal. There was deliberately no formal training. Very deliberately, as I'm listening to Mary Douglas a couple of weeks ago, and she. To tell stories around that theme.
Why deliberately? They decided that it would injure your mind to be because you wouldn't know what you would need to know, therefore it would be better to go with an open mind and not be...
Yes, it was better to go with an intelligent quest or an intelligent open mind than with a preset... set of questions, a preset idea of what one's going to do.
And what about methodologies?
The methodology kept company. One learnt methodology by asking what other people had done. And Godfrey had bought a series of, I think, invoice books or receipt books.
Mm.
And essentially kept a large diary all the time.
Mm.
With details, and that's what I did.
The invoice book had a piece of carbon paper, so you could cut it, break it into little bits. Is that
yes, that's right.
Like Fraser.
Yes, I didn't actually do that. Mm. I wrote on both pages.
Mm.
it was only when going to East Africa when the tradition of Audrey Richards and Malinowski meant that one needed to carbonize, one needed to copy one's field notes and send a copy back. To the Institute.
Mm.
That's when that worked.
I see.
But a method, it was very haphazard.
Mm.
One took genealogies and one started off looking at economics, the mode of livelihood, and one went from there to other one.
Mm.
Had informants, all these things, but you discovered all this by yourself. And it meant that there wasn't, it meant that one didn't study one, even though I went to the Banyang, because they provide a significant number of migrants to the Cameroon plantations in the south. That was only really an excuse for my grant.
Mm.
I was still expected to make an all-round study of Banyang, and I soon latched on to, secret societies, I suppose.
Who's your supervisor? Was it?
It was Jim Bohannon.
Ah, was it?
Yes.
Was he at Oxford at that time? Or?
He was at Oxford. He was a lecturer at Oxford.
You say Jim Bohannon?
Yes.
I thought he was called Paul.
Jim. He is called, but it's PJ, I think.
I see.
So it was...
Same man.
Bohannon. Same as Laura Bohannon, it's Dusty Bohannon.
did you keep much in contact? I mean, was it expected you sent back letters and reports to your supervisor at that time, or was the post so bad that it wasn't?
No, I wrote a few letters, yes. You wrote a letter, so you say what you were doing, but you didn't send reports.
Mm.
And it was... yes, it was in my second field work that EP was the supervisor, and I didn't write a great deal. I wrote to him, but I didn't write regularly. Mm. It wasn't very formal.
So you did a second field work?
Yes.
So the first one was a PhD?
The first one was a PhD, and the second one was then I went out. It was a time when people were moving out from the special ethnographic areas as defined, and I went from West Africa to East Africa. As E.P. said, I would then become an Africanist rather than being a West Africanist.
Mm.
So the idea was, yes, to extend my knowledge. It was interesting, really, because I went from one corner of the Bantu land, from a semi-Bantu or Bantoid people to a Bantu people, and there were connections between them, which have ultimately gave me the basis for a paper which appeared only a couple of years ago, like this year.
Mm. But how did you fund a second piece of fieldwork?
Well, the second piece of fieldwork, this was when Audrey Richards was director of the East African Institute of Social and Economic Research. I think it was just social research, wasn't it? And they were looking, at that time, they had a research policy of a kind of expanding frontier from Kampala, and the courier, the people whom I worked with, were on that frontier. No one had made a study of them. And they were looking for someone to work with courier. Again, a very general remit, and make an anthropological study of the courier, social structure of the courier, whatever it was. And so I was appointed as a fellow of the East African Institute, and with that remit. Though when I went out there, Audrey had left and Tom Fellers had come in as the director. And I wasn't entirely happy. I don't quite know why, but I was encouraged to go out and have a look, see if I think I wanted to study the Maasai for some reason. But I went out to East Africa and made a tour around. And felt, in the end, quite happy to go and work with courier. And I'm glad I did. It was an interesting thing to do.
But you, even though Audrey had gone, you must have got to know her later, did you?
Yes.
I met her a few times and I've got some film of her. How would you assess Audrey?
Well, things have been said about Audrey from both Oxford and Cambridge, and I suppose those things are in my mind. She was a very generous person, and when I came to Cambridge, teaching Cambridge in 1970, she was very generous and welcoming. Tom Fellers was really the director of the Institute while I was there, and he was a very significant person. I think he was, it was a different regime. He was the most charitable person, very gentle, very acute intellectually, very, very sad when he died.
He died young, did he?
He died relatively young. Yes, he must have been in his 50s when he died. I mean, he just finished his study in Uganda, the Soga, Bantu bureaucracy, and he'd gone back into, I suppose, Chicago anthropology. And he was a very important link between British social anthropology and American anthropology. And it was, I suppose, when he died, it must have been in the 60s that he died. And because he was here in the 1963, and then he was ill then, in the decennial conference then.
And he influenced you quite a lot.
Yes, that's right.
In his method, or his theories, or his personality?
A kind of persistent inquiry. And it, in East Africa, the Institute had set down a questionnaire. It was very much more organised, fieldwork-wise, and one made copies of one's notes and one put them into various categories, which I still have.
The Malinowskian method of saying this is economics and this is
that's
social
right.
life.
Yes, yes, it was very much the Malinowskian method that was still always used there.
It come through Audrey down to.
It had come through Audrey. That's right. That's right.
Who else was at the Institute when you were there?
Who was there? Walter Elkin. Names.
Don't disappear. Worry, it's a long time ago.
Names disappear.
Yes. But then one person we've sort of touched on briefly, but I'd like to just come back to for a moment, is E.P. Because many people regard him as the greatest anthropologist, I think, of the 20th century, or certainly one of the two or three greatest. You said at the beginning, I mean, when you first met him, you were impressed by him and you went to his lectures. Did you continue your high regard for him?
I was always impressed by E.P. When I first came into anthropology, even at Cambridge, it was E.P. and E.P.'s work which most impressed me. And it has continued to do so. No, I.
What is it that you think is at the heart of that greatness?
He was a big man. I mean, he took on board lots of people. He was always a person of immense integrity, so that while in an informal situation, he could say outrageous things.
And did.
Nevertheless, on paper, when he took up a pen, he was an enormous scholar. I mean, his scholarship was very great, and so that. I mean, he looked outside anthropology, and I think his own life moved, his own career, intellectual career, moved. Particularly my own field has become anthropology of religion. Of course, he stands there as immensely significant. And I think, yes, I think his work has not been fully... quarried, I suppose. An enormous amount of work. I mean, we have recently commemorated his the 100th anniversary of his birth, and
You've read Mary Douglas's biography of him, probably.
Yes, it's more Mary Douglas than E.P., isn't it?
Yes.
And it's perceptive. But a bit, I mean, it's in a way before his time, the theme that Mary Douglas takes up. And there's a biography waiting to be written on E.P., and it must be written.
Although a lot of his papers were destroyed, unfortunately.
Well, he destroyed a lot of his papers, but they, Ahmed Al-Shahi has... his and Godfrey Leonhardt's papers and Peter Leonhardt's papers has remained, yes. Because it's rather like Freudian analysts, they succeed each other and these papers have been accruing.
But why has this person got them?
I think because Godfrey was E.P.'s executor and Al-Shahi is Godfrey's executor.
And where's Al-Shahi?
He's in St. Anthony's in Oxford.
Oh, good. So somewhere safe.
Yeah. Yes, it's safe.
Yes, because Deirdre, his daughter, had some diaries and things of his.
Yes.
But
And there is an autobiography, I gather.
Is there?
Yes. Gosh. How?
I think that was what she
finished.
Mm, she had. Yes.
She had. Mm. But now I've come back to Unchained. Yes. Mm.
Good.
Yes.
So you then went to the East Africa Institute, and then after that you came back to Edinburgh, was it? Was it?
To Edinburgh, yes.
As a lecturer? Or?
Well, as an assistant, not even an assistant lecturer in Edinburgh. And this is Penniman, is it?
Yes, Tom Penniman.
Penniman had started the anthropology course in Edinburgh, and Kenneth Little took over, and Penniman was away, had finished, had gone back to New Zealand when I came in, which this was 68, sorry, 58, 58 that was, and I was in Edinburgh for 11 years until 1970. I'm very different in anthropology, and hugely,
under the shadow of sociology?
No, but sociology didn't exist then. Mm. The social sciences faculty.
Or philosophy?
Or,
I mean, the great Scottish Enlightenment, you were probably in the David Hume building or something.
Well, I think I was instrumental in giving the name of Adam Ferguson to the Adam Ferguson building. Oh, that was only in the late 60s that I was there. There was the David Hume Tower, which was being built, that's right.
I gave it to that there,
time.
I remember.
Yes. Yes, the Scottish Enlightenment figured large.
Mm.
And of course it figured in the nature of the degree course, which was a 4-year degree course, which now has, or since I left, has the enormous advantage of being able to do some field work or field exercise anyway in the last year, but they weren't doing that then. But it was huge first year classes and smaller honours classes of 20 people or so, but a large catchment area that people could come into and become interested in. That's right. As there were some who came in through the large first ordering classes and went on to.
Were there any teachers or students that you particularly remember from that period?
Well, Michael Banton.
Well, he was at Edinburgh.
Before he went to Bristol. It was then shadowed by, well, influenced by Kenneth Little's interest in race relations. That Kenneth was early in that, and so Sidney Collins and Michael Banton had both been brought into the department with a race relations brief, though they did other teaching as well. And Jimmy Littlejohn was there. So it was quite a large department. Mary Bird was also there, who was a West Africanist who worked in the Yoruba. And I think that was about it.
Did you find it a stimulating environment?
Well, it was stimulating teaching anthropology for the first time.
And you liked living in Edinburgh? Or?
Edinburgh was a nice place, yes. It was a good place to be and bring up a family.
You were married by that time.
I was married by that time, yes. And then, now, when I first, as it were, when EP first suggested I go on to do field research, he said that he would support me on the understanding that I didn't write a novel or get married in the next 5 years.
That's the old colonial promise you had to take when my father went out to tea and things, you know, not until your first home leave could you get married.
Yes, that's right, yes. Mm. And it was, oh no, the Bohannans are the marvellous example of a married couple who went out and deliberately lived apart.
Mm.
And since I wasn't married, it was, he was Evans Bishop was concerned that I would be singleton.
But you came back, you married and you went to Edinburgh.
I came back, so I married, yes. Mm. When I came back from East Africa, married and went to live in Edinburgh. Little did I know that the day I joined Edinburgh was the 2nd of July, 2nd of January. And I suppose it was 69 it must have been, 2nd of January. And the New Year still goes on the 2nd of January in Edinburgh.
For some time. Mm. Yes, and it was the student revolutionary years, but I suppose it wasn't.
Was later, it? Yes.
Was this, you said 69, or do you mean?
I mean 59. Yeah, yes, I mean 59, yeah. Yes. Right. So another 10 years, and there was student unrest.
But that's when you came to Cambridge, about 70.
And that's when I came to Cambridge. Mm.
What
yes.
made you decide to come to Cambridge?
Well, as I said at the time, I respected the Scots too much, wanted to become a Scot. So I was, and I'd been 11 years in Edinburgh, and I'd come up through being an assistant, which is a Lucky Jim kind of job in Edinburgh, through becoming a lecturer and then senior lecturer in Edinburgh. And it was time to move on, and it was universities were still expanding in the 60s. Were expanding in the 60s. So I felt I could come to Cambridge at that time, and wouldn't want to come. And I could always move away from Cambridge, but little did I know that the university world was to change in the 1970s, and there was to be much less movement. Yeah. So I came to Cambridge because I liked Cambridge. Mm. It was nice to come back to Cambridge, where I was a Cambridge man. Mm.
There wasn't any push. I mean, there are rumours that Jimmy Littlejohn, towards the end, became not such an effective head of department, putting it mildly. I mean, that he suffered from one of the less pleasant sides of my Scottish ancestors' predilection.
It wasn't the case at all. It was quite other. That in the late 60s, Kenneth left being head of department, as you know, and the principal was concerned that he did leave, did resign from being head of department. I remember very well that I met the principal, and he asked me if I would become head of department. And it wasn't the chair that was being offered, but simply the head of the... But at that time, I'd already been appointed to Cambridge, and indeed became a fellow of Clare. It wasn't a bit... Now, Jimmy, although senior to me, it was felt he would not become a good head of department. And I think when he did, when he was appointed and took the chair, he actually visited other universities and other departments to see what departments were really like. So I wasn't pushed by Jimmy, but
When you came to Cambridge, of course, you came to a department of social and political sciences.
Yes, that's right.
With the head who was an Africanist and no doubt a friend, John Barnes.
Yes.
Let's start with John. I mean, you worked with him for many years. And I've interviewed him, and he's an old friend of both of us. How would you paint a quick portrait of
John? Well, I think he's a good commentator. I think he...
As in Three Styles of Kinship, or...?
As in Three Styles of Kinship, as in other papers that he's written. I mean, he's very intelligent, very acute, but he's not a leader. He's not, it was the Social Sciences Committee, it wasn't a faculty at that time, was established. And I was aware, I suppose I should have said this earlier, that I was aware that the Social Sciences Tripos was established, and... yes, it was through a letter from Edmund Leach, that actually I applied to come to Cambridge. It was Edmund saying that there was, you know, that I was then a senior lecturer in Edinburgh that there was no senior lectureship, so coming to a lectureship in Cambridge. And I think I was encouraged to apply by Edmund. I'm the only person, I'd hate to say it, that, who I know to have been appointed to a post in Cambridge who had no interview. I wasn't interviewed for that because there were three appointments at that time, to sociology, to social psychology, and I think I was the more senior of the three. And I think they wanted to interview them and not... so, yes, and so came to you know, a committee-run TRIPOS that was looking for direction. And John had seniority standing, but didn't give it direction, I hate to say. And
It drifted for many years.
It drifted.
Well, I was on the committee for many years, so I saw all that. He was a very efficient man, a very fair man, a very nice man.
A nice man, yes.
But not bossy enough.
He had no view of what kind of
no vision, as they say. Yes.
And there were real problems. The real problem between anthropology and SBS.
Yes.
With the anthropology prizing its social anthropology, prizing its manifoldness and uniqueness, I suppose, both manifold and some. What do I want to say? It was in one place, and it didn't work. And the vision that of a natural science of a social sciences tripos on the pattern of a natural sciences tripos didn't come off.
No. There were long negotiations, of course, but they never came off.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yes. You mentioned another figure, the person who wrote suggesting you came, Edmund Leach, who is obviously a huge influence on Cambridge anthropology in the second half. Any pen portrait of Edmund? I know towards the end you read his textbook and weren't very impressed.
That's right, his textbook. Well, I mean, he moved anthropology on. I mean, he was so totally different from Evans Pritchard, and of course fell out with EP.
What was the cause of the falling out?
Well, I think it was really his Highland Burma book, in which he discounted fieldwork.
Which book?
Highland Burma, beginning of Highland Burma.
Oh, Highland Burma. Deaf, so I thought you said Higher Burma.
No, Highland Burma.
Yes.
Political systems, Highland Burma.
So it was the discounting of fieldwork.
It was discounting of that, and discounting... Gadfly, spurring things on, which he did marvellously, and, moved anthropology away from the kind of natural historical mode of classifying all the societies that you put into and
butterfly hunting.
That's right, butterfly collecting. It moved it on. Really important figure, but yeah. Not on the same stature as EP, and I aroused EP's wrath. I remember him in the, was it 73 Oxford decennial conference, somehow or other.
Edmund tried to kind of crown EP, didn't he, on that occasion, and EP just rejected it.
It was towards the end of EP's life.
And he sent me a postcard when Edmund was made Provost of Kings, with saying, "I see they've made Caligula's horse Provost of King."
Yes, that's right.
He didn't like him. In fact, he resigned from the British Academy.
That's right, he resigned from the British Academy and, accused him, said, "You should read some books," he said, in the conference. Yes.
But then, so you taught for quite a few years in SPS, didn't you?
Yes. In
So how many years? About 8 years or something like that?
It was about eight. No, it was more than that, a lot more than that, because it was from 1970 to about, I don't know, 86, I was 85, really? Something like that. It was only in the last few years that I, when Tony Giddens came to take over SBS, and I felt there was no future. I was always straddling something in SBS.
You had a half post in both, in fact, didn't you, at some point?
Well, the post was funded from SBS, was and it? Whom I was responsible to was very uncertain whether I was responsible to the head of the Department of Social Anthropology or whether I was responsible to the committee. Social Sciences Committee. When Tony Giddens came in, and I forgot what point it was, it was clear that I could no longer straddle the two subjects. I think Giddens wanted me to be the social anthropologist in SBS, but this was ridiculous when there was a social anthropology department.
Papers,
more important figures and so on, that it had to be integrated in some other way, that I left SBS and moved fully into social anthropology.
I mean, did you personally get on with Giddens, or...?
I personally got on with Giddens. I mean, he was a certain kind of swashbuckling figure.
What about the other ones there? Jeffrey Hawthorne?
Jeff Hawthorne, yes. Well, Jeff Hawthorne was important. And Richards.
Martin Richards.
We were the first three and very different. And had very different tasks, as it were, when we were there. I don't mind, and in Edinburgh I was in the African Studies Centre, and I quite like being a link person between subjects. So I was happy to be a kind of link band in SBS, but the link was a very difficult link to manage.
Then you came across for about your last 5 years to the Social Anthropology Department, and were even secretary of our department. I remember you organising the lecture lists and things. When you encountered some of our swashbucklers, our leading swashbuckler of the time was Professor J.R. Goody. Any thoughts about Jack, who I've also interviewed and is a long time friend?
Well, a great admirer of Jack. I'm a very political man, and you know, marvellously into academic politics. An existential thinker. He gets his teeth into an existential problem, and that's marvellous. I thought very vigorous and very good to be in a department with him.
How would you placed, as I would, EP as a really great figure.
Great figure, yes.
And John as a very good commentator. Where would you place Jack?
An important figure. Important for, again, opening up the subject, in a way, I think, more effectively even than Edmund. Gregarious, and in a way intellectually gregarious, which is a good thing to be in as an anthropologist, and doing, you know, the lectures that encourage people in labouring subjects for anthropology, which is a typical Jack thing.
Rivers lectures.
The Rivers lectures, that's right. So, important in that way, yes. I don't know.
One doesn't know which bits will last forever, but...
Well, Significant, yes.
Some of his literacy work, certainly, I think.
Literacy was very important, rift to open up, wasn't it?
Mm.
And the kinship in Europe, I think that's an important line. Mm. Not easy to read, but very energetic, which is very good.
Mm. Were there any others there?
Well, Tambaya. Mm. I think Tambaya was very impressive.
Mm.
I had to decide when I, in 1984, when I was having a sabbatical in America, whether I wanted to go to the AAA conference or whether I prefer to meet and have a talk with Tambaya, and I thought it better to have a talk with Tambaya.
Really?
Mm. Yes.
Mm. Yes. Are there any other anthropologists of that era we should have mentioned?
I should mention
Mary Douglas or anyone else. You mentioned her in passing, actually, but
I've mentioned Mary in passing. Yes.
Darrell Ford, I suppose he's a previous generation.
Darrell Ford's a previous generation. Who else?
Godfrey.
Godfrey seems to be very important. Godfrey's book, extremely important.
Dinka Religion.
Dinka Religion, yes, that's right.
Even his textbook is very good, actually, on
the social anthropology. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yes,
very
that's
thoughtful.
Right. Yes. And Godfrey was an important figure. I think those are the important figures that have stayed with me. Rather more closely now, having just come back a fortnight ago from Oxford, where E.P.'s spirit, and certainly Godfrey's spirit, is still very much alive.
Mm.
Probably more to me going back than to the people who are there now, who have probably passed on a long time ago.
Mm. Mm. So the main change you saw in anthropology was from very specific holistic studies of particular societies to now a much more
problem-oriented, yes, and he has much less focused or has a series of local foci.
Mm.
That's certainly the main change. Yes, much more applied, much more related to problems.
Mm.
Sort of practical problems, policy problems.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't. I remember having a talk with a colonial officer and who was interested in policy problems, and I took it in, but I didn't take it very seriously. Whereas I think one would much more so now. And I still, in a way, believe. That was the best anthropology, where one was looking for what were the significant features in the societies one studied, and went on from there.
Mm. Mm. Which perhaps explains why you've now shifted towards art, which has, as we know, no use whatsoever, but is intellectually important and interesting. I mean, when you were an anthropologist, you weren't particularly interested in art, were you?
No, not as I wasn't allowed to be. In my day, when I went into anthropology, one, studied the flooding system of the Hypernhia Rufa in the southern Sudan.
Mm.
But I did in Edinburgh. I was involved in setting up an African art exhibition, and when I was a lad, I was interested in art and did a little of it.
Mm.
I suppose that's going back to earlier interests, that's right. But also taking intellectual interests with it, so that I enjoy talking about French painters.
Mm.
With intellectual questions about them.
So you paint as well, obviously.
I have painted, I've stopped painting.
Have you? You collect paintings.
I collect, paintings and what goes for art these days.
The odd pyjama or bit of bedding or something. Yes.
Yes.
So, and you read about history and philosophy and nature of art.
No, I don't. I read about artists. Or art traditions. Mm. That's right. And I try and work out why it is that, you know, what it is that Matisse or David or Chardin, what's special about them, what's significant about them, the same way what is significant about the Banyang, what is significant about Chardin's art, and how it relates to Rococo in the 18th century, and try and say something about it to people who are willing to listen.
Do you teach in the University of the Third Age?
Yes, I do.
Well, I thought that was a hint of that. Well, that's a very positive note, and I hope you have many years of happy exploration. I envy you greatly, I must say, but one day I'll be joining you in the U3A. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Malcolm. I enjoyed that. Thank you.
Bye.